I am impressed that so many of you are still here. It's a long seminar. I have a comment that someone wrote down that I think is a very good one. In the New Testament, we can see that at that time, their view of Messiah was one that he would come to restore the nation of Israel. So their Jesus didn't fit their view. And he did fit the view sometimes of the weaker people. He didn't fit the view, especially of the Pharisees. And but remember, when he ascends from Mount Olive, the Mount of Olives in the first part of Acts, remember, they just stand and stare. The disciples, it's like, well, what happens now? And they have to be told, you know, when are you going to restore Israel? They were still wondering, when does that happen? When does the nation of Israel get restored? No, under Roman rule, under the rule of the Messiah. And they were told, just go preach the gospel. It'll happen when it happens. And they just watched. It was like, are you serious? To the world? I mean, I can't imagine what that would have felt like at the moment. I think I'm going to go fishing. No, you were not allowed to go fishing, right? We have to go do this. At the same time, oh, he's not going to restore Israel right now. Now, there's prophecies made to Israel in the Old Testament, but that had that wasn't Christ's first coming. Although, remember, he did tell at one point one of the people there he met, he said, I've come now to the nation of Israel. Now, then he told his disciples, when I'm done, you go to Israel, you go to Judea, Samaria, and the world. We go out from there. I'm just starting this. You take it out. And, of course, that's what we're still trying to do today, is take that out to the world. So I thought that was a very good comment. Their idea, especially if you were a Pharisee or an Essene, of the Messiah was totally different. He was going to come as king. And as the one gentleman said, they had many Jews had belief in two Messiahs. One that suffered and one who was king. Now it's one Messiah. He comes twice. Please, I can email this an answer if I think it's too controversial. Are Catholics and Mormons Christians? I find that there's no purpose in condemning people. I would just say that Catholicism and Mormonism, the movements, I'm not talking about people though, have a long ways to go to be first century Christians. But so do we. Okay, so do we. I'll talk about the Apocrypha. That's beyond anything that I can talk about right now. I'm going to run out of time, so sorry about that. I'm not an expert on the Apocrypha anyways. Although, First Maccabees is important if you want to understand what happened with the Jews there during that time of the Greeks, when the Greeks ruled. Okay, where are we now? What we looked at the first part of the second century, these trends happening. The desire by many Gentile Christians to separate for anything they saw Jewish. Because the Jews were in a revolt and they didn't want to be caught up in the Roman net that was going after them. Acceptance of Hellenistic religion. We find this Platonic Greek philosophy coming into the religion, and also the influence of Gnosticism. These things, plus the fact that you have churches and congregations holding on to bits and pieces of what had been the original Christianity, and it's all getting into a very complicated soup. But before we think that's too weird, I don't know if that's a whole lot different than the United States. Christianity in the United States is a very complicated soup, right? So, yes, I'll be, understand what they were going through could be similar in some ways that we're going through. And that's why I want to bring out one story that I think is very fascinating. And this happens in the mid to late second century. There is a disciple of the Apostle John who lives in Asia Minor, modern day Turkey. His name is Polycarp. And he kept a Passover service on the 14th of Abib, the first month of the Jewish calendar. Now, these were not Jews. These were non-Jews who had become Christians, and their leader had been taught personally by John, the Apostle John. And he gets a little upset, and I'm going to go through this story because I want to show you the debates and problems they faced and how something was changing in the power of what the church was, if to put it that way. So what happens is that he writes a letter to the Roman bishop Anicetus. So he's not called pope yet, but he is the bishop of Rome. And the bishop of Rome was considered, by this point, he's sort of important, okay? Mainly because it's the center of the empire. And because there is some debate, did Peter ever go there? And they're saying, yes, he did. Although there is zero proof, according to Catholic writers, that he started the Catholic Church there. But you know, whether he went there or not is always debated. If he was there, he wasn't there early in his career. He was there towards the late part of his career when he died there, possibly. So what's happening is the Bishop of Rome, he starts to promote Easter. And Polycarp says, but that's not what John taught us. John taught us on the night that Jesus was crucified, he got together with his disciples, and they took this bread and they took this wine. And keep this in remembrance of my death. So we do this in remembrance of his death. And of course, then we honor his resurrection. But you're taking this away, which it, for a long time, this Passover service was at least part of. Even people kept Easter, tended to keep both in one way or another. You're doing away with one to keep this Easter service. And he said, we won't do this. And Anicetus writes back and says, well, yes, you do. You have to do it. And basically, Polycarp goes and sees him. And they decide that they can't fix the problem. And they agree just to leave it in peace. So what we have are churches around Rome now are keeping this Easter ceremony. And the churches in the Asia Minor are keeping a different ceremony. They're keeping a Passover service in the way that they said John had taught them. And since John had gone to Ephesus, there's no reason to think he hadn't done that. So Polycarp dies, Anicetus dies, and there's peace. Well, Polycrates follows him. He's a disciple of Polycarp. And this now becomes a critical point. And he confronts the new pope. Because at this point, I can't say pope, but they're getting more and more power in Rome. Okay? The Roman bishop is getting more and more power. So Polycrates confronts him. And I'm going to read just part of the letter. I put it in the book. I edited it down because it's a long letter. But I'm going to read just part of it. He says, For our part, we keep the day scrupulously without addition or subtraction. For in Asia, great luminaries sleep, who shall rise again on the day of the Lord's advent, when he is coming with glory from heaven. This is page 156, by the way, if you have the book there. When he is coming with glory from heaven and shall search out all his saints, such as Philip, one of the 12 apostles, who sleeps in the Areopolis, and two of his daughters, who remain unmarried to the end of his days, and his other daughter, who lived by the Holy Spirit and rest in Ephesus. Now he supported his position by claiming that the apostle John, who also sleeps in Ephesus, as well as Polycarp and a number of other prominent church leaders, observed the Passover on Abib 14. Among the other leaders was Melito, who lies in Sardis, waiting for the visitation from heaven when he shall rise from the dead. Then he says, all these kept the 14th day of the month as the beginning of the Paschal festival, Passover festival, in accordance with the gospel, not deviating in the least, but following the rule of the faith. Last of all, I too, Polycrates, the least of all, act according to the tradition of my family. Some members I have actually followed, for seven of them were bishops, and I am the eighth. My family has always kept this day when people put away leaven. So I, my friends, after spending 65 years in the Lord's service and conversing with Christians from all parts of the world and going carefully through all Holy Scripture, am not scared of threats. Better people than I have said we must obey God rather than men. These weren't the only people to do this. And the reason we know this is because of later times. When Constantine held the first Nicene Council, and we think of the Nicene Creed, one of the things he said was, we have to shut down the Quattro Decimans. That's a long time after this. They're still all throughout at least Asia Minor and probably other parts of the world. The Quattro Decimans means the 14thers. And so here you have a major controversy. And there's numerous controversies you can find, and you can just show these controversies that are happening. And what's happening is, more and more, Rome is becoming the power who determines what is acceptable and what's not. And what happens is, the Bishop of Rome at this time basically excommunicates Polycrates and all the churches of Asia Minor. And some other bishops come along and say, you really can't do that. Come on. I mean, that's not what Anicetus did. Anicetus said, well, you keep the 14th and we'll keep Easter. We'll just leave it at that. And they convinced him to reinstate the churches in Asia Minor. And they got reinstated. But even though those churches over the next four generations would adopt more and more of Roman ways, they still never really came together. And that's the reason why you have the Orthodox Church in the East. They just never would submit to Rome after this. Even though at this time they didn't have a lot of Roman customs that were becoming very common in the Roman world outside of Rome. They slowly would adopt many of those customs, including the use of idols, icons, praying to saints. They all would do that too, but they still never trusted them. And to this day, they will not accept the Pope as their leader. They accept him as a great person in Christianity, but you're not our leader. You talk about far-reaching effects. But what's really interesting is we have a group of people that are doing what they were taught to do by the Apostle John. There's no reason to believe that any of this isn't true. I mean, every once in a while you'll go through one of these writings and say, that didn't even make sense. But historically, you can prove something's not true. That's why the Acts of Peter or the Gospel of Judas and all these, that's why they're not true. You read them and there's nothing in common with the Bible. I mean, the Gospel of Thomas is about Jesus as a child. And he's the most nasty little brat you can imagine. You know, somebody treats him bad. Some man yells at him. So he kills him. You're dead. He drops over dead. You know, this isn't Jesus, okay? And yet that was a fairly common book that we still have, you know, today. So this becomes a real controversy. Most or many scholars today, historians, believe the Quattro Decimans were right. They had it right. That the Passover, when Jesus said to his disciples, I wish to eat this Passover with you. And Jesus is the Passover. I mean, he is the Passover. He was establishing something specific, and they saw it as something you kept at a specific time every year on the night that he was betrayed. on the very night that he did it with them. Henry Chadwick, famous, I mean, he has written a book on the history of Christianity, which is considered a classic. It's printed by Cambridge University. He makes this about the quarto decimals. It is impossible, and so weighty a practical question, for diversity to be allowed, right? Wait a minute, you're keeping Easter, we're keeping the 14th, Passover. You can't do those two things. Say the Passover sounds too Jewish. But there can be little doubt that the quarto decimans were right in thinking that they had preserved the most ancient and apostolic custom. They had become heretics simply by being behind the times. We're going to find that a lot in the second, third, and fourth century. You become heretics because you're not moving with the flow. And I find this one interesting because you go back and you read John 13, 14, 15, 16, 17, what Jesus taught that night with his disciples. And then you go read that account in Matthew and Luke and Mark, they all have little different details on what happened that night, and you think, it appears we're supposed to do this. We're actually supposed to do this. And it disappeared from Christianity. So, opinion here, I always say, my opinion is we're supposed to do it. They did it. And I think we're supposed to do it. And these people were persecuted for it. And eventually shoved out through the Nicene Creed, the very first one, we got to get rid of these people. Hey, pardon?
Not very nice.
No, not very nice. I hope you mean Constantine, not me, but... There you go. I don't know. Someone yells out, it's not very nice. I hope it's not me. You set yourself up for that. So a new orthodoxy is growing. Now what I want to do is I want to tell you, or just point out a few men that are really important in building this orthodoxy. Okay? Their writings. Remember I showed you Tertullian. He's one of them. There are some of his writings. Now you get into the 400s and it's Augustine. Augustine is the one who sets up doctrine for the entire Catholicism of the Middle Ages. Martin Luther was an Augustinian monk, and he held on to some of that. So Augustine's impact is great. Augustine's also very smart. Very smart man. I think he's a very sincere man. But because of allegory, he took the whole Bible in a different direction. You know, he took Barnabas and took it way beyond that. So let me talk about a few men that is, you just know their names. And we have to know something. Backstory, give you a little backstory. In 331 BC, Alexander the Great took Egypt, went out on the shore, on the coast, drew out some lines in the sand, and he said, build my city here. He left a bunch of Greek soldiers, some Greek engineers and architects, and he left. And they built Alexandria. Because Alexandria was going to be the center of Greek culture in Egypt. Alexandria, Egypt exists today. So he starts this. He builds this. And this becomes probably greater than Athens as the center of Greek culture in the world. In fact, when Julius Caesar shows up and he comes into Alexandria, for some reason, no one knows, but while he's there, because they had the largest museum and the largest library in the world, it catches fire and burns to the ground. Now, there's no proof that Julius Caesar was involved in that. There's have been attempts to make him have done that. There's no proof that he did it. But he was there when it burned, and they couldn't get it out. But it was a huge library and a huge museum. And it was the center of Hellenism. So here we have, remember I talked about Clement of Alexandria? Okay. 153 to 217. Remember I said that he looked at Plato as sort of someone who prophesied what was going to happen in the Christian church? Remember Paul said the law there, he's talking about that old covenant, was a school teacher to bring people to Christ. Remember him saying that? Law, okay. So he's not saying all the law has no meaning. It's a school teacher to bring people to Christ. Alexandria, Clement of Alexandria, who is an absolute student of Hellenism, student of Greek philosophy, he teaches that Greek philosophy was the school teacher to bring the Greek world to Christ. Now you understand what I'm saying. He's saying the Old Testament is for the Jews to bring them to Christ. Plato, Socrates, Aristotle, they're the ones to study to bring the Greek world to Christ. Go look up Clement of Alexandria. He's considered one of the great fathers of the Christian church. So now we see what's happening at the intellectual level. You know, what's happening at the quarto decimans is happening at the practical level. But this is happening at the intellectual level, in which Greek philosophy is part, you have to learn Greek philosophy to study the Bible. Okay? His greatest student was Origen. Origen's fascinating to me. You'll never meet a more dedicated person. But boy, he was unbalanced in some ways. Origen, he wrote volumes and volumes of work. As a teenager, he decided he wanted to be a martyr, so he'd go out and pick fights with Roman soldiers. His mom used to hide his clothes because he didn't want to run out naked to keep him from going out. By 17 or 18, he was actually the headmaster at a school. That's how smart he was. He was the number one teacher at a school. He tried to die for Christ and he couldn't, so he became an ascetic. He would sleep on the floor. He wouldn't eat anything but bread. He almost died from the way he treated his own body. If I just treat my body badly and for Christ, I will be better. And it's part of an ascetic movement that's starting. And so he becomes an ascetic, and he just lives this harsh lifestyle. He's sick all the time. How dedicated was he? He read where Jesus said that there are eunuchs for the kingdom of God. So he made himself a eunuch. So you can't argue his dedication. You can argue his balance. His balance. And his writings contain some of those things. Remember I said Plato believed all souls were created in heaven and were put down in human bodies? Origen taught that. Origen went as far to teach that the stars were living beings. Now here's this man who wrote all these volumes, became very famous, and helped shift the wave of Christianity towards Hellenism. And he was excommunicated after his death from Catholicism. Later, as they started to develop things, we don't want him anymore. But they couldn't help it because it was too important, so they brought him back. They just wouldn't give him a special title. I forget, they gave him a title that's not as, he's not up here, he's down here. But they had to bring him back because, we can't escape from the fact he's important in our development. But, boy, did he have some weird ideas. Of course, he comes from Alexandria, Egypt, the center of Hellenism. There's one other person that comes from North Africa, and I want to mention him, Tertullian. And these three begin to create the thought processes that moves farther and farther from the Old Testament. Now, they didn't reject, especially Tertullian, he didn't reject the Old Testament, but he didn't think in terms of the Old Testament. He thought in terms of allegory and these new interpretations, and they were all influenced by Platonic ideas. He comes from North Africa, actually comes from Carthage. And here, even Tertullian, all them, and Clement, you see ideas like the eighth day from Barnabas. It's introduced here, and over the next 100 years, it keeps showing up and showing up as an explanation of something that it's not biblical. I mean, there's no biblical eighth day. But this new doctrine that has been formed and is passed on. Actually, during his lifetime, he was excommunicated by the Bishop of Rome. He became part of a movement. The only way to describe it, it seems like it was almost like a modern Pentecostal movement. So he became part of that, and he was excommunicated. But once again, later it's like, I mean, how can we excommunicate a man who wrote this much? So both Origen and Tertullian are now back in the sort of the major developers of what became the Catholic Church. They claim they're all Catholic. At the time, they were still arguing what the universal church even meant. Okay, they all claim that they're still forming. Now, I want to start into something else before a break, unless there's some other questions. Because we're into the real heavy stuff here. Okay, this is the hard stuff, because we're outside the Bible. But we're into this time where you're thinking, how's this be going on? And we don't know what the average person's believing. What seems to be that's all over what is the Roman Empire, the average person that's a Christian believes all different kinds of things. That's what it appears. And all we can look at is certain movements and certain people who wrote a lot, and their writings became important. Okay, let's move on. I didn't think there'd be... Origen is not exactly everybody's favorite subject. I may be the only person that finds him interesting. Yes?
You know what? Actually, I think I went ahead of you because I went on 46. Earlier on, you talked about the eighth day. And the first time I heard about the worship of Sunday was from the Roman. So I was trying to figure, what's the difference between the Sunday and the Sunday that is mentioned with Constantine compared to the eighth day.
Okay. When Constantine makes a... We'll get it. We'll talk about that in a minute. Because when he declares about the Sunday being a special day of worship, there's a complex reason why he's doing that. The eighth day was just a development of a whole theology that, like I said, nobody today teaches the eighth day. But a whole development of a biblical or a doctrine without a biblical basis, and you can't say eight people going into the ark justifies an eighth day mystery day, okay? I'm just showing how this formed to justify a certain line of thought that said Sunday should be the day of worship. But in a way that, like I said, is ridiculous. And nobody would agree with that today. When we get to Constantine, he has a lot of different reasons. And it's really not has to do with the eighth day. That's a theological argument that he would not have cared about. Probably wouldn't even have known. Okay, so that was a good question, though. Okay. Oh, is that it? You want to take your break now, or you want to go another 10 minutes and then take your break? Yeah. Now? Okay, let's take it now. And then, I tell you what, we'll come back and we'll end before 4 o'clock, because I know everybody's getting tired. So we'll end before 4 o'clock.